The date is the 6th of June 2014. We are talking to...
Walter Gumperidge.
When were you born?
1st of March 1933.
And where were you born?
In Münster, Westphalia, 50 kilometres from the Dutch border.
Tell us about your family.
Well, father, mother, sister 1 year older than me. So she was born January. She was born on the 25th of January, if that strikes a bell with anybody in Scotland.
Right. Burns night.
Yes. Now, you want to know when I was born? I was born the 1st of March, which is also an interesting date in Britain, because that happens to be St. David's Day, who happens to be the patron saint of Wales. So when I was at school, and they asked me in grade 6, what's your name? I said, Walter Gumperidge. Don't you have a middle name? And I said, no, I don't have a middle name. She said, well, you, teacher said, well, you have a middle name, you just don't know what it is. Home, ask your mother. So when I asked my mother what my middle name was, she said, you don't have a middle name. So I figured, if there's one thing worse than having my mother, the teacher think my mother's stupid, do stupid, give me a middle name. So finally, on the way home, way to school, I thought, well, my Hebrew name is David Ben Shlomo, after my grandfather. So I got to school. Teacher asked me, and I said, yes, I have a middle name. I said, what is it? I said, it's David. Oh, she said, I should have known, because you're born St. David's Day. So I went home and told my parents that I was born St. David's Day. That was the reason I was named. Yes. They thought that was... Yeah. So anyway, that's my name, Walter David Gumperidge.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
One sister, 1 year older than me.
What was she called?
Brigitte, then now became Bridget. My name was Walter all the time, anyway. Uh-huh. And then, since she's lived in Israel all her married life, since 1953, she is Gita.
And what did your family do?
Well, my father was a grain merchant and imported grains, and that's why I was familiar with the Winnipeg Grain Exchange. I mean, I'd heard of it after, I was in Germany. But distributed them in Westphalia, Rhineland, and parts of Germany.
And did you go to school in Germany?
No, I didn't, because when I was due to go to school, it was too dangerous to go to school. My sister had gone to school the year before, but she didn't go to school the year that I was due to start either.
What happened in 1933 to your family?
Well, of course, the outstanding result was that I was born, obviously the highlight of the year, but also the fact that 29th or 28th was when Germany became a dictatorship, and at that time things changed drastically, and a lot of Jews realized that, I mean, they were anticipating that if this happened, that life would become untenable, because the party that came to power, or took power, had outlined a program of anti-Semitism. It was quite extreme. It was so extreme, it was unbelievable. But it rapidly became known that it was believable, because laws started to be passed. And one of the first was that Jews weren't made given Bürgerschaft, or citizenship, and so I was one of the fortunate ones that was not given citizenship, German citizenship. And I did, so I was basically stateless until 1948, when German Jews in Britain were allowed to apply for British citizenship, and my parents did, and your parents probably did as well, I'm sure, and became British subjects and citizens. So that was the first, and so then all sorts of things happened. I mean, my father couldn't, I think it was a couple of years after that, but 1936, 37, that... the idea was to isolate Jews, and so Jews weren't allowed to do business, and non-Jews that did business, well, the Jews were listed and publicized that you wouldn't find it. Germans wouldn't do business with them. So it was completely impossible for Jews to do business with non-Jews, okay? And since the farming public were almost entirely non-Jewish, my father was basically out of business. So for the years, for sure, 37 and 38, and he did absolutely no business at all. So it was, he's tried to, and in fact, one of his business associates left for Chile, and that's where we eventually got papers to immigrate to Chile.
How long did that take?
I don't know how long when my father first applied, and you know, because I say I wasn't privy to that information. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 6 years old when we left. I was born 33. Consequently, but
did you go to school?
No, I didn't. It was too dangerous to go to school. Oh yeah, well, my mother. Okay, so it was 1936, I believe. The Jews had to sell their cars for 1 mark, because that was legal tender, okay? So my mother, 2 weeks before, she had a nice BMW. It still made its 3 Series. Mm-hmm. It was the first year, 1936, that it was made, and that's when she got it, my father bought it for her. So she went to the assistant police chief, who she went to school with and knew personally, and said, because the police force were going to get this car, and it was a nice car, and he didn't have enough seniority to get it, probably. So my mother said, you can have it right now, on one condition, that when you're at work, and the police station was only 2 blocks up the road, Grevenerstrasse, where we lived, you can have it right now. So he said, fine. Well, it sort of helped him a little bit, because he felt a little better, you know, at least he'd been given it. I mean, even though, you know, it was still stealing, but nevertheless. So my mother had the use of the car. And so my mother had the Deutsche Sportabzeichen, which is a precursor to the Olympics. It was a sports medal that's usually just for professional athletes, but my mother was an athlete. And it's an engraved medal, and she made a point of wearing it. So she was driving the car downtown Münster, and she was stopped by a Nazi who came out from Berlin and stopped the car. And as he approached the car, my mother preempted and said, what do you want? And he looked at my mother, and he saw the Sportabzeichen, and he said, oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. So my mother looked aside, and she saw in the doorway of hidden was a local Nazi who had told this guy, she's a Jew, stop her, she's illegally driving a car. But when this Nazi saw the Sportabzeichen, he said, well, every German knows that Jews aren't athletes, and having a Deutsche Sportabzeichen means you're eligible for the Olympics. He can't be Jewish, okay? So he apologized profusely and let my mother go. Well, this is sort of the thing. So you're wondering if the Jew just could walk downtown. He'd never know when he would be accosted and said, you're doing something wrong, doing this wrong, and they had no rights in the law at all. Mm-hmm. They had just no legal rights in Germany, period, being Jewish, you know.
Can I ask what type of athlete she was?
Decathlon. And so she did swimming, high jump, cycling, and long jump, I know, and sprinting. So it was a mixture.
And was she in the Olympics?
No, she wasn't allowed. She was Jewish, what do you want?
So she wasn't allowed.
So, okay, so she was a member of a Preußische Sport club in Germany,
right.
Okay? So, and I don't know whether it was 33 or 34, the government said, fine, if you want to compete athletic in any national event or get any funding or anything at all, you are not allowed to have any Jewish members. So what are the Jewish members supposed to do?
They formed their own clubs.
Right. What could they do? We did, in fact.
Nothing.
My mother did form, and my mother and father did form Münster Club, but it was just for Jews. So you had no competition of any consequence.
So your mum is feeling pressure, your father's feeling pressure, and they've got the papers to go to Chile.
Not yet. So my father was interned in the Münster prison, right?
Was this after Kristallnacht?
Yes, yeah. Kristallnacht was November 1938. Mm-hmm. We're now in August of 1939.
So they were arrested in Kristallnacht?
No.
No.
My dad was arrested early August of 1939. Oh, you see, my father had an Iron Cross first class in 1916. 1916 was still worthwhile getting a Iron Cross first class. Latterly, it was the end of the war. Basically, if you survived the war, you were given an Iron Cross. My father made a point of whenever you went anywhere, you wore it, and that was respected. And they couldn't just throw everything out, you know. They couldn't just say, well, Jews were given a different Iron Cross than regular guys, you know. So, and that's maybe a reason that maybe I could at least get around town. And he was fairly well known in town. My dad's in prison, and as I mentioned before, the prison, periodically the SS would come and see if the prison was full, in which case they'd take a load of men to the concentration camps. So that shows that, but the German police were used to say, no, no, the prison's lots of room, though the prison was absolutely cramped. And the reason they did that was the police knew very well that going to a concentration camp was not a good idea, was not a healthy situation, that there were people dying of all sort of diseases and whatnot, and they weren't just Jews at that point, there were also political prisoners that were in there. You know what I mean? Willy Brandt, you know, who became mayor of Berlin, he escaped because he was a socialist to Norway. And he didn't go there for the sheer hell and delight. He went because it was dangerous to stay in Germany. Okay, and he left well before 1939. So anyway, so when my father had initiated the getting the papers to Chile through a friend of his who was there already, and my mother finalized it when she came to prison with the papers, my father was released and came home. And so then we immediately made effort to get to the out of Germany, and to get to Germany as a well, it was not it wasn't feasible to take public transportation because it was too dangerous, and with two kids you'd be held up all over the place as we were at the border. So my father's first World War friend, who he was with in right through the 4 years in the French front, Franz-Josef Wietfeld, he drove us to the border. He was able to do this because he was a Catholic priest and he was papal nunciate to Westphalia, which was a fairly high-ranking individual. Namely, he was the Vatican's representative to Westphalia. And Münster being a largely Catholic area, most people there were Catholic. The Archbishop von Galen was in the interesting, very interesting individual, was Archbishop at the time. And Franz Josef Wietfeld didn't have the okay of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church sort of just... they were having trouble with some of their own priests who were like Franz Josef Wietfeld, who were helping political prisoners that were being unjustly put under pressure, and Jews as well. So, but just for the record, the rabbi in Münster, who had been there for some years, after Kristallnacht, went to see an audience with Archbishop von Galen about the pressure that Jews are being put under and being put to death and so on. And the Archbishop's reply, in short, was, you brought it on yourselves, you didn't accept Christ. Now you can check it out with the book. Anyway, but and that was the general attitude of the. But the fact that people are people, well, Jews apparently weren't people, okay? Even though Jesus was a Jew. But nevertheless, so I don't know. I have to emphasize that my life was saved by a Catholic priest, Franz Josef Wietfeld. No doubt about it, because when we got to the border, I spoke to Uncle Franz in 1951 when I was back in Münster with my mother. And I said, what exactly happened at the border? He said, well, you know, I went to the border. Franz is a big guy. And his nickname was Kürbiskopf, which means cabbage head, you know, among his friends. I had his clerical collar, and he was a big guy, and this little SS guy was trying to give my father problems, and all the papers were in order, wasn't going to, you know, was saying, this is this, and you have to do this, and so on. Franz Josef Wietfeld walked in front between my father and the Nazi, namely right in front of this little guy, and he said his nose made it all the way up to his middle of his chest, and he said, in German, "To me of us," or as Clint Eastwood would say, make my day. And they hit me because this Franz Josef Wietfeld would have knocked him really, you know, but he had to have the first. And then he waved my father and my mother and us over the border and gave them the papers, took them out of his hands and gave them the papers. And he said, Franz Josef Wietfeld said, it was that simple. You know? And he didn't do himself much good because as a result of his attitude, because he was put under considerable pressure during the war. All sorts of things. I'd phone him up at 2 o'clock in the morning and there'd nobody on the phone. But he had to answer the phone because he was a priest who had to give last rites and so on. He couldn't just say, to hell with the phone. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there were all sorts of ways of putting pressure on people. So, Anyway,
did he survive the war?
Yes, he did. He did. He actually died in a train accident in 1961. Mm-hmm. But he survived the war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was he arrested and put in a concentration camp?
No, he wasn't. No, he couldn't. Munster was a pretty solid Catholic. And von Galen, his attitude was rapidly anti-Nazi. Mm-hmm. Completely. Now, he had a really good reason. He had a reason because he was actually Graf von Galen. He was a landed aristocracy, and he gave his title to his younger brother, right? So he wasn't just an archbishop. He was really somebody, nobility, so to speak, of the day. And had a fantastic sway over it. So even the Nazis, couldn't quite grab this guy. Just couldn't do it, They never went in the dome, which is the cathedral. So he was an absolute German patriot. The aristocracy, so to speak, really weren't Nazis. They wouldn't lower themselves to become members of the Nazi Party to start with. That doesn't mean to say they weren't financiers of the Nazi Party. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to some of them after the war. It's interesting.
Yeah. So you're in Holland.
Yes.
How did you get... Well, no car?
No. Well, we were picked up back to the border by my mother's uncle, one of my grandfather had three brothers and a sister, and one of them lived in Holland. They'd moved there before 1930. His wife was Dutch, I guess. And they didn't survive the war, though, but that's another one. And we were there a week, and then, so a week before the outbreak of the Second War, a week before the end of August, we went to Britain, moved to Britain. My father had managed to get a transit visa to Britain. He wanted to actually get a complete visa for the whole bunch to Britain, but couldn't. But he got a 3-month transit visa through a cousin of his who was already in Britain, who went in 1933.
So he managed to get you visas?
He got us transit visas, 3 months. So we're in Britain. So after a week, we're in Britain, the war broke out and all transportation was stopped.
Yep.
So then we were actually in London with a cousin of my mother's, my mother's aunt, and then all Jews that were enemy aliens, which we were, weren't allowed to stay there because it was a strategic area, and they figured there'd be an invasion, and what they need German spies there, which we were considered to be, what they know about us. So we had to get out of there, and we went to Manchester en route to Glasgow.
Why Glasgow?
Because Glasgow, in the event that my father incidentally was interned in the Isle of Man right away, so it was just my mother and my sister and myself at liberty, so to speak. And Glasgow was an area that needed workers and skilled workers in agriculture, and my father was. And so in the event, he was in the Isle of Man, but nevertheless he figured one of these days he'd get out, and when he did, he'd be in Glasgow. So my mother got there. My mother immediately started to work. And my mother worked in a factory that made great coats, that's heavy coats for army soldiers, great coats. And my mother, before she was married, had a certificate for making shirt collars. And in Germany, you get a certificate for all sorts of things. And it's a pretty skilled thing. It was a 2-year apprenticeship and course and one thing and another. And shirt collars were... handmade shirts were the thing in Europe in the 30s and before the Second World War. And so it was a developing job. So she certainly knew how to make great colours. That wasn't a big... And first she was on time work, then she went on piece work and made really what we call serious money.
Mm-hmm.
And was able to look after us quite well. I never knew we were poor. I mean, we probably were, we couldn't afford all sorts, but it never occurred to me that we were poor. I mean, I was a kid,
So did she start working while your father was in the...
Oh, yes, sure. We didn't have any money. Sure, she worked. Had to work. Somebody had to work.
And where were you living?
In Glasgow.
Yeah, but what part of Glasgow?
Oh. Sounds good. Pollock Shields. We lived in 43 Kerr Street, right opposite the Pollock Shields Senior Secondary School. And then we moved to 248 Camure Street, which is a little further away, which is not too far from Melville Street School, actually. It was a corner. I actually lived the corner of Kemmerer Street and Leven Street. And the next street over, I believe, is Melville Street. And the Melville Street School was just down there. And so it's very easy for me to get to school.
And was it easy to enroll you into school?
I don't know. I got into school. I don't know. I wasn't... I didn't have any trouble. I was told to go to school. I went to school. And the only problem was that the kids were all deaf and dumb. To a man. Well, I only spoke German. I mean, I didn't speak English. And so my mother actually said she was pretty sure that the kids would learn German before I learned English. Because I spoke... Nobody told me it was a different language, and nobody told me it was difficult. So I didn't have those handicaps.
When you say deaf and dumb, was it a special needs school?
No, but they didn't hear me. They didn't comprehend. I wasn't sure what their problem was.
Right.
But they had the problem, I didn't.
Yeah. So you went bouncing in.
Bridget, or whatever, she's not as talkative as I am. At least she wasn't then. But we never missed a year. You know, we kept up. In fact, they wanted to kick Bridget up a year. And my parents said, no, they don't want that because she'd be with, wouldn't be with her peers. And so Bridget was... the classes then were about 30, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you call them because they're that large or not. But anyway, and Bridget was always... Francis Duff and Helen McNabb, the three of them, were always head of the class. It was just a matter of who was up there. And so the language was not... a difficulty. It just was absorbed. It maybe made it easier for us to learn other languages because of the attitude that we had towards learning a language.
Did the teachers help you?
Pardon?
Did the teachers help you?
I really can't remember. One thing I remember was Miss Switson, who was my first teacher, when it came to... And my mother spoke some English. I mean, she learned English at school, but she wasn't fluent. I remember my mother coming home and said... The teachers weren't, they didn't pay you compliments, the outrageous compliments. You know, they told the truth. They were like, nowadays everybody's wonderful and everybody passes and every child is a genius, you know? And parents were the same. Parents didn't tell children they're wonderful and they, you know, like, you know, work, you know, they had to work harder. That's what you heard. Anyway, but my mother said, what did Miss Switzer say? Said, you have a very good voice and you sing very well and your fingernails are very nicely cut. Instead of cutting my fingernails straight across, you know, one cut, my mother contoured them all the time. And this apparently was exceptional at school. So that, well, maybe Miss Switzer said something else to my mother and it might have been complimentary. But I wasn't told that.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let's put it that way. So what did I know? I made friends at school. I didn't have any trouble. Certainly by the time, I think we were 1 year in Albert Road. It's called Paul Schill Senior Secondary, Albert Road Academy, whichever name you want to use. And then we went to Melville Street. And by that time, I was fully integrated. I had a little gang, and Monty McMillan had a little gang, and Ian McCall had a little gang. Well, this is the thing kids do in the playground.
Yeah. When did your father come home from internment?
He came home, he was interned almost a year. So he came home the latter part of 1940. And then while he was in the internment camp, he met some people who were also in the livestock feed business. And there was one guy named Mr. Rosenthal who'd already gone. He came to Britain in 1936. Well, that was a cut-off date, apparently. So guys that came in 1936 and 36, 37, 38, 39, they were all still... He already had a business, but he was still in the internment camp. He wasn't in very long. He was in 3 months. But in the meantime, he and my dad made arrangements that my dad would represent all the agencies that he had. My dad could have them for Scotland, because he didn't have anybody in Scotland. He was in England. He came up short of Yorkshire. And when Dad came, he had to start finding customers for the agencies he had. course, cars weren't, you, it was impossible to get a car, so everything was done by foot, by bus, and by train, and so on, and that's what Dad did. And Dad was 48 when he came to Britain, so he wasn't a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
And though he spoke some English, he certainly wasn't fluent, but well, I guess he made. If you got it, you do.
And then, did you have a Scottish accent then? Did you have
pardon?
Did you have a Glaswegian accent?
I had whatever they had. Whatever they had, I had. I got what they got. What I heard. I repeated what I heard.
Carry on about your dad.
Okay, well, my dad, so I came in 1945, of course, well, and, you know, he'd made some progress in his business, though he couldn't import anything, and he started up doing serious business and formed his own company, had a Scottish partner, a guy named Robinson, from Gilchrist, from Rutherglen. That's where I made this, that's the where his warehouse was in Rutherglen at Gilchrist. That's where Robinson worked. And so it was pretty hard slugging. And in those days, people smoked a lot. Being what we nowadays consider overweight, it was the norm. It was considered if you were skinny, you were poor. You know, things have changed substantially. And of course, my dad had a share of worries. And so in 1950, when his business was going quite well, he knew he was in bad health. He was too much for a hurry. Even then, he put on even more pressure, and he had three massive heart attacks and died in 1950, 9th of September 1950. I was 17, and I'd finished high school, and the idea was that I would end up going to my father's business, and the way to do that would be A, to go to university, and B, get some practical experience with another livestock feed company, and then come back to the business. So that was just the start of that part. I did my 2 years national service. I could have evaded, because being in agriculture, you could have got around it, but I felt that government paid for a lot of my schooling. I mean, I got a bursary through university. Yeah. And then, so I went and did my 2 years. I volunteered for the army, because by volunteering, I could get into what I wanted to. I wanted to get into the Royal Artillery, because I didn't feature myself being in the infantry, which was sort of, it's also pretty dangerous. And certainly didn't want to go into the tank corps, like sitting in a tin can getting fired at. I didn't like that. And my father had been in the artillery, and field artillery was what I preferred, because it was my dad was actually in the heavy artillery. My father got his Iron Cross when he was in the German regiment that looked after what is nowadays called Big Bertha. It was a huge gun that traveled on railroad tracks. And interestingly enough, when I was at Mons OCS, that's the Mons Officer Cadet School, I was being interviewed by a colonel, remember his name, Benemy. And he was First World War man. And he looked through my papers, and he said, "Gumperch, see you volunteered." I said, "Yes, sir." He would just answer, "Yes, sir," at everything. And he said, "Family?" And I said, "Yes, sir." Namely, it's a family reason for joining the artillery, volunteering with a family. And he said, "First World War?" "Yes, sir." "Where?" "France?" "Yes, sir." Oh, no, he got really interested, you know. He was like, "Where?" He actually had to ask, you know, I had to say something. And I said, well, I know I just can't say yes, sir, but so it sort of got personal, almost. It was a place called Lyon, because there are pictures of this church, which is an odd church tower, and I've been there, and it's definitely Lyon, where my father fought. He said, "When?" I said, 1916. "Oh," he said, "what's your name again?" "Gumperch. Shouldn't I know your father?" And I said, "No, sir." "Why?" Because he was on the front. He was in Lyon in 1916. And, you know, the lines were pretty stationary.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't as if you moved around.
Uh-huh.
I said, "Perhaps because he was on the other side, sir." And he looked back and he said, "Oh, the Kaiser's boys." Like, this is heaven to know a son of the Kaiser's boys. One of his buddies. He tried to kill, but it's all right, you know. And he said, "What happened?" And I said, "Well, my father was decorated Iron Cross First Class." And he said, "Was he a lieutenant acting as a major?" And I said, "Yes, he was." "Well, the major was on leave. The colonel had shell shock. And the adjutant, who was a captain, was out of it or whatever. And my dad, actually what happened was," and this is what this colonel explained, my dad never talked about it, "but what happened was the British attacked and routed the Germans. And according to the colonel, a young lieutenant rallied the German troops and fought off the attack, giving the Germans enough time to withdraw Big Bertha along the railway line and get the heck out of there," which is, that's why the British attacked. They wanted the gun. And he, the colonel knew that it was a young lieutenant who was later promoted to a captain. He said, "Big deal." And he was pretty sure he'd get Iron Cross First Class for this particular deal. Yeah, so that was Dad.
How did the British officer know what was happening behind the Germans?
Oh, they played soccer on Sundays, that's why. They played soccer, they played football on Sundays. They all got out there and played soccer.
I thought that was only at Christmas.
Ah. Well, these guys knew each other. He knew who was who.
Yeah.
And he wasn't in the German army, I can guarantee you that.
So you did your national service, did you have to go?
Well, I did 1 year. 1 year I was fooling around, taking all kinds of courses, and I took a parachute jumping course, I took a Remy course. Great stuff, you know, Rolls-Royce engines you have to take apart and put together, and excellent instructors, and parachute jumping, five jumps was a dream. And then, of course, you never got the final one because they asked you, "Are you willing to sign on for an extra year?" And I said, "Well, I'll think it over." Well, they knew that meant no. So, I mean, you never got the few pennies extra. And so then, when I went after I went through Monzo OCS, I wanted to go to Hong Kong, and I applied for Hong Kong, but you had to have 14 months left, and I didn't. I only had 12 months left. So I applied for Germany, and I got that because I was fluent in German. And so I spent a year in the British Army of the Rhine doing winter warfare skiing and marathon running in the summer. I didn't do too many parades.
Which year was this?
1954 to 56. I got out on the 9th of October, 1956. The reason I remember was that it's when the Suez Crisis broke. And it broke actually either that day or the day after, because I was at Woolwich. I was being demobbed, and they were waiting for the bus to go down to Woolwich station. And I didn't wait for the bus. I took my kit bag and walked down to Woolwich station, changed into civilian clothes in the waiting room, and hopped on the first train. Because as a territorial, I wasn't smart enough to get into the Army Emergency Reserve. They were already called up, incidentally. You see, everybody tried to get in that. Well, I didn't get, I was lucky I didn't. But I realized that the next thing was they were going to call up the Terriers. Mm-hmm. And I was on the train. Well, they could easily recognize me by my haircut. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I was out of Woolwich.
And you were coming back up to Glasgow?
Right. Absolutely.
So you arrive in Glasgow.
Yes.
What was the community like then?
Well, I really wasn't all that interested. First of all, because really we just circulated in the German Jewish community. We belonged to Paul Schiele's Schule, which was just up the end of Leven Street, mm-hmm. On Maxwell Road there. I mean, it was really close. But and it was turned into a mosque several years later. But nevertheless, okay. I mean, we just went high holidays in Sukkot. Mm-hmm. And Pesach.
Mm-hmm. So there you are, you're back in Glasgow.
Yeah.
You've done your national service. What do you do next?
Oh, I sat looking for a job. So, long and short of it was, the jobs I was offered didn't look terribly, prospects weren't all that good. I didn't mind the initial work at all. It was just that they looked it looked as if I'd have to be old before I could get promoted. That's basically the nuts and bolts of it, okay? Mm-hmm. And that was just not, I think that was generally the way things worked. You know, you had to have seniority and you were in. So I was working for a guy and I said, after 2 weeks sorting invoices, I thought it was pretty good because this way I was getting to know the mix of products that customers wanted, right? So if I went to the farm, I know if he wanted such and such. Well, I ask him, what does he need this mm-hmm. as well, you know? So, I mean, I thought this was okay, and I was memorizing a lot of this stuff. And
You weren't just filing, you were absorbing the information.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, you know, not just keep my eyes closed. I mean, why not do something with the time? My dad used to say, whenever I do something, he said, very simply, don't waste your time, you know? I mean, you could have said, use your time well. He said, that's the bottom line. Don't waste your time. So basically, if you're doing something, it doesn't matter how stupid a thing you're doing, maybe you can do it just a little, that's what he also said, whatever you're doing, maybe you can do it a little better than somebody else. Just a little better. A little bit. Okay. So when my boss came to me and said, we should really be having you do advisory work, but you look too young, you really don't have credibility.
Whereabouts in Glasgow was it?
It was a company out of London. It was Kilmarnock, but the company was in London.
Right.
It was BOC, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, right, okay.
So I thought, the idea of my getting training somewhere, you know, was almost on a world basis. It wasn't as if it had to be in Glasgow. I mean, not that any country was ever mentioned, but Dad did business with Canada, with Winnipeg, you see, that's where the grain exchange was, Winnipeg. And so I always sort of thought of experience being all over the place. So anyway, so I said, how would it be if I got some experience overseas? Oh, he said, that'd be wonderful. I mean, that puts a different complexion on things. I mean, that's experience that's mm-hmm. unique and... Mm-hmm. That might serve something that the customers might be interested in, and the knowledge itself might be of value. And he said, where? Well, I hadn't thought of anything. Quickly thought, well, you know, got to be an English-speaking country, so you go Australia, and America, Canada. Australia's an awful way away. I have a cousin there, only two first cousins, one of them's there. America just had McCarthyism, that's no good. I don't like that way of operating a country. In Canada, probably got the same wage scale as America, namely high, and even better, it's got big cars too, which I like. So I said, Canada. He said, where in Canada? Well, the only place I really knew was Winnipeg. So I said, Winnipeg. Oh, he said, wonderful choice, of course, the grain exchange. Would you want some references? I said, no. Okay, well, the reason I didn't want any references was I wanted to get experience on my own. I didn't want, you know, you really only got the job because, you know, they felt sorry he lost his dad when he was 17, so stuff, you know. So then I had to go to the Canadian consulate in Glasgow. And he was very helpful, a young guy. He said, we can offer you a free trip to a job in Canada. He said, that sounds pretty good. Where is it? And he says, it's in northern Manitoba. And you get a free passage and everything, and you contract for 3 years. Well, that's job security if there was one. So, well, I think all important things over for overnight, so I'll let you know. So I came back next day, and I said, I don't know the cost of living in Canada, and I don't know exactly where northern Manitoba is and what it is and what the social life and whatnot, you know. And I said, you know, riding on the range has a lot of appeal. It's a lot better than what I did in the Scottish Highlands with a sheep, unobedient sheepdog at my tail for 2 days, and after that he was okay, but maybe horses are smarter. But what I do is I look at the contract, you can put my name on it, but I'm not going to sign it until I get to Canada and I know what's going on. And I'll let you know a week after I get there, because by then I should have an idea what's going on. And he said, well, that's not exactly what we got in mind, but I'll pay half. And you report to the CNR people when you arrive in Winnipeg.
Who's CNR?
Canadian National Railway. They're the people that sponsored this program.
Oh,
Canadian National. Maybe CPR, Canadian Pacific, really are the same thing, but CNR were the ones that were, they'd been colonizing Western Canada for the better part of the century. That they were the people that got people out there.
Did they have to do background checks on you?
I don't know. Maybe they did. I can't really remember. Uh-huh. I mean,
just maybe. Basically, they wanted bodies to come out.
Well, yeah, and he knew I had a degree in agriculture, and I was single, boy. You know, so anyway, got out there. 10 days before I left, I got a letter from my father's brother who lived in Trinidad, and said he's got a cousin in Winnipeg, and maybe I should write to him. So I did. I wrote to him, and as I was leaving the house, my mother and I were taking a taxi to the train station because I had a big trunk and a big suitcase. The postie, Mr. Hawthorne, came running up, and I knew Hawthorne very well, and he'd been delivering mail to us for 20 years. So, I mean, I really knew him. And he came running with a sealed airmail letter and said, "Walter, you've got to read this letter. It's from your cousin in Winnipeg. Going to go meet you at the station." No, he'd opened the letter. That's okay. He was part of the family. But he absolutely made sure I got this letter. And so the voyage was February. I sailed from Liverpool. From Liverpool to Halifax. But this consul said, "You can take this boat and there's no extra charge for going Liverpool, Halifax, New York." And he said, "Not only but is the train fare cheaper for them, of course, from New York, but it's a regular train, a regular compartment for regular people, whereas the train from Halifax is a glorified cattle car for immigrants, not terribly comfortable at all. So I recommend stay on the boat when you get to Halifax. It's a day's sail, you get into New York." So I did that. The other thing he told me was, "The only bad thing about that is you have to get a visa, since you have a British passport, to go through the United States. So you've got to go to the American consulate in Glasgow to get this visa. No charge, but you just get it. But he said, you've got to watch, they'll ask you some questions, and don't be what we nowadays call a smartass. When they ask you whether you've been a member of the Communist Party, just say no. Don't say, 'What the hell, you know, is you trying to do here?' You know." And he said, "Not only that, but don't wear a red tie. Be really safe. Wear black shoes, not brown shoes." Well, you laughed at that one, but I did exactly that. And sure enough, I went there and interviewed this little kid of a vice consul. I said, "Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" I didn't breathe. I didn't say anything. I just said no. So I got to New York.
And then you took the train up to?
Yep. And on my way through, on the train, was this big French Canadian. And he wanted to see my passport. And he saw this 2-year work permit that I had in there. And he said, "I'm going to give you this." And I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's a landed immigrant status." I said, "I don't want it, because I figured maybe I'd do national service all over again in Canada." I didn't know. And he said, "You've got to have it or throw you off the train. You can't get into Canada." Okay, so I've got this lousy stamp. And that's, of course, what nowadays everybody's been looking for. It's just a little stamp. I operated with my British passport till 1975. Because the day I landed, I was able to, well, I think it was after 3 months, I was able to vote. I just had all the rights of a Canadian citizen. In 75, that changed. You got to be a Canadian citizen as well as a British subject.
So when you were in Canada and people said, "Who are you?" Were you German? Were you Scottish? What were you?
They just assumed I was Scottish. When I got a job after... Well, I had a job within a couple of days. Not in what I wanted, but after 3 months I did. I was right in the feed business. Mm-hmm. But I was posted to a place called Dauphin, Manitoba, and for Canada Packers. They were the biggest in Canada, and it was a nice company. Being accepted was just it was never a topic of conversation, for sure.
Because everybody's an immigrant.
Yes. There was one man in town, Mr. Oliphant. He owned the hardware store. He came from Glasgow when he was 6 years old. He was an orphan. When I got to Dauphin, I was told, you've got to go and see Old Man Oliphant. He was an old man by then. Nobody can understand him. So I went to the store, and Old Man Oliphant, and spoke to him. He first greeted me. I couldn't understand a word he said. And I said, I'm from Glasgow. I was coming. He spoke quite normal Canadian. He said, that's the reputation I have. Nobody can understand anything I say except the price. And he was popular. I mean, he was a good guy. He knew his stuff. I mean, he spoke something that wasn't Glaswegian. It was just something. Anybody from Glasgow would realize this was not...
This was a made-up accent.
He made it up all on his own. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then, so you had your job, and then later on, was it when you retired that you started working for UNESCO?
Yeah, and I worked out of Winnipeg, mm-hmm. Dauphin for 3 years, Morden, Manitoba for 3 years. And then I moved to Saskatchewan in November 1962, and worked for Intercontinental Packers for 25 years. And then I did international consulting for United Nations FAO Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Bank, CEDA, Canadian International Development Agency, and they farmed me out to different people. Yeah, I worked on 6 continents. I missed one.
Which one was that?
Antarctica. There you go.
So all in all, what message would you give to anybody listening to your story? We're going to have a lot of school children. And
I think, yeah, when you look back, I think that about 2/3 of it is at it of I don't want to say successful life, because I don't want to say I have a successful life, but I mean I have a good life and I enjoy life. Getting there, I'd say 2/3 of it is attitude. Unfortunately, a good chunk of that comes from your parents. So if you're born into the right circumstances, you've got more than just a head start.
And your mum must have been a very strong person.
Oh, yeah, my dad was pretty strong, too. You know, I mean, and yes, my mother certainly was. They made a really interesting pair.
And your sister went to Israel?
My sister married in 1953. And moved to Israel. Anyway, so Bridget moved to Israel and got married there. And she's lived ever since. She has 4 boys and 11 grandchildren. They're all in Israel.
And you married?
I married in 1964. Tomorrow it'll be 50 years. Tomorrow it'll be 50 years.
What's your
7th
wife?
Of June.
What's your wife's name?
Oh, my wife. Lois. Lois Kay. We met in Winnipeg. She was just finishing up university and finishing off 3 years of being Manitoba fencing champion, foil, you know. And so I live a dangerous life, just
absolutely.
So you know. Every minute, no damage at all.
And how many children have you had?
We have 4 children. They all live in Vancouver, in the same part of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. I can cycle there. The furthest is 35-minute cycle run. One daughter lives just across the back lane here. Yeah, we have 5 grandchildren, and we see them pretty regularly. I mean, we see at least one way or other, bump into them once a week. We live far enough away so we don't see them leave their houses. Every second Friday we are together, Friday night supper. We moved from Saskatoon to Vancouver here almost 8 years, and we decided, because 3 of them were here, and the one that was in Saskatoon had been working here, but they're all very good friends and they do all kinds of things together, and they have done all their life. The middle two were competitive sailors. And them coming to Saskatoon twice a year, I mean, we had the room, but an awful expense, and that way we don't grow up with the grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. And the climate's better.
It wasn't really that much of a consideration.